The Vintage Gamer, Episode 19, Dragon Con Report, and Moonshot.
This show is a member of Goblin, the gaming broadcast network, gbncom.com.
Hello, and welcome to The Vintage Gamer, the podcast that seeks out great games from an earlier era. I'm your host, Jim Van Verth. As always, this show is available via RSS or direct download at www.thevintagegamer.net. Sorry, no funny sponsor this week. Actually not feeling all that well, so here I am. I'm suffering for you, or maybe I'm suffering for my art. In any case, this is going to be a short show this week. So to start off with, I've got a warning. The show is mostly reminiscing, so there's not much gaming content up front. That content comes in the latter half, so if that's what you're looking for, skip a bit, brother. I'm going to be spending the first half of the show talking about my experiences at Dragon Con, and then because those are pretty much game... Well, there wasn't a lot of gaming going on at Dragon Con, at least not for me. I'm sure there was plenty of other people gaming at Dragon Con. I'm going to talk about a game that I got to play about a week ago called Moonshot. So, on to Dragon Con. I rode down with Murr, of course, and Davey Beauchamp and Rich Siegfried, Mr. Adventure. Those guys can talk a lot, and they are a lot of fun, so I highly recommend taking them with you on your next road trip. But you might want to ask if they want to go first. Honestly, spent a good deal of Dragon Con sleeping. I got there, I was sick. I had been sick for about a week and a half prior to getting to Dragon Con. And because of that, I slept most of Friday. And managed to drag myself out of bed, get my raggy body to the podcasting panel. This was the gaming podcasters panel that I had organized. Actually came up with this idea back in March and rounded up some people for it. And wasn't sure exactly if it would end up on the gaming track or the podcasting track. The podcasting track being new this year, and being set up by Mike Menengay of Farport Media, Tracy Hickman of the Dragonhearth podcast, and Murr, of course, and run by Derek and Swoopy of Skepticality. But it went on, and it went really great. I want to give a big thanks to Caroline of Game of the Podcasting, Sam Chupp of the Bears Grove podcast, Don Dam of Pulp Gamer, and Bobby Blackwolf of the Bobby Blackwolf Show for participating. And also want to give a really big thank you to Swoopy for helping to keep the discussion going. If you want to hear the podcasting panel, the audio is up on the Bobby Blackwolf Show feed. I will, of course, put a link to that in the show notes. Thought about putting it up on my feed here, but hey, why not? Give it all to Bobby. Right after that, we did the pod play for Lancelot Biggs, Spaceman, and that went really well. As well, that's kind of redundant, but you get the idea. We did have some audio problems. Well, at one point the speakers going out to the room cut out. That was due to the audio engineers trying to improve the recording quality, which, you know, I guess makes sense, but it was a live show after all. But we had fun, and my voice held out. It was really good. The big highlight for me was the fact that T. Morris was standing next to me and sharing the microphone, and I had to step back so he wouldn't shout in my ear. T. is a little louder than I am. Just a little bit. Anyway, the audio for that should be up on the Balticon podcast, hopefully. The next morning, I went and participated in Tracy and Laura Hickman's Killer Breakfast, which, if you don't know how that works, basically it's an RPG session where the Game Master's goal is to kill off all of the participants in the most creative possible way. I started off playing a wizard with a gambling problem, which is to say that the NASCAR goals, yes, there was a NASCAR theme to the proceedings, that showed up. I dived under the table to avoid them because I was afraid they were coming to collect. But eventually I got wiped out, died horribly, you know, 100 points of damage, things like that. And spent the rest of the time chasing beach balls, and don't ask me to explain that. Another part of that is that they had a karaoke session where, I'm not sure, I guess it was Tracy, took some country songs and wrote new lyrics for them to fit the proceedings, and threw up lyrics on the screen. So we all sang along. That was a lot of fun, too. It's all very silly. I highly recommend, if you can participate in a killer breakfast, that you go. And next year, if you're at Dragon Con, please come, because they could have used a lot more people there. It was not as well attended as I'm sure Tracy and Laura would have hoped, and I was hoping, certainly. By the way, if you're not familiar with Tracy and Laura Hickman, Tracy, together with Margaret Weiss, is the co-author of the Dragonlance novels. Tracy and Laura are also co-designers of the Ravenloft module, this is both for D&D, and have a podcast, Tracy and Laura Hickman's Dragonhearth. And they're also a couple of the nicest people you'll ever meet. Later on in the day, I crashed into the How to Break into the Computer Gaming Business panel, which I've participated in the past, so it was somewhat appropriate. Mike Capps was the moderator for that one, and the other people participating were Garner Halloran of Red Storm Entertainment, which is where I work, and Ken Leitner, formerly of Holistic Design. He's now working for a mobile games company whose name I'm spacing right now. And then there was a guy from EA and a guy from Funcom, and I'm sorry, I'm spacing their names entirely. The odd thing about this year's panel is that there were a lot of artist and designer questions. Usually it's a little more balanced, you know, programmer, artist, designer questions, but there weren't really a lot of programmer questions. And since most of the people on the panel were programmers, it made it kind of difficult for us to answer those. So next year, clearly, I need to prep more to find out what sort of criteria are used for choosing artists and designers to get into the gaming industry. And then, at 7 o'clock, we had the Parsec Awards, which is the big sci-fi podcasting awards that Murr and Mike Meningay and Tracy Hickman put together. Congratulations to all the winners. Most people did seem happy with the results, so I think it was a great success, and I think it'll come back again next year. The presentation itself, I thought, was amazingly put together, considering that it was the first year. Tracy Hickman created this great AV presentation with a DVD and some credits flashing in and out. I mean, it was pretty low budget. It was cheesy, but it's an awards ceremony, for goodness sake. So I thought it was entirely appropriate. There were some glitches. Again, first year, didn't have a lot of time to rehearse. But people dealt with it well, both on the presenting side and on the audience. I actually got to participate a little bit in the Parsec Awards, being part of the Hobbit tossing team with Patrick McLean of the Shaughnessy and Rich Siegfried, Mr. Adventure and Requiem of the Outcast. If you want to hear my lovely Hobbit effects, actually I think I did grunting effects for tossing the Hobbit, but anyway, you can hear that at the Parsec Awards website, which is www.parsecawards.com. And a big congratulations to Murr, Tracy, and Mike for pulling it off. Did I mention it was Murr's idea? Well, it was. After that, there was a loser's party for the people who were nominated in the Parsecs, but I actually skipped the early part of that to go to the Dr. Floyd show. For those not familiar with the adventures of Dr. Floyd, it's a 5 or so minute podcast where Dr. Floyd and his assistant, Dr. Grant, go chasing the evil Dr. Steve through time and space to prevent him from selling the artifacts from history on eBay. Dr. Floyd was one of the winners of the Parsecs, and Grant Boccaccio, who does the voice of Dr. Grant, Dr. Steve, and Dr. Steve's sock-shaped assistant, Fidget, accepted the award. And I actually got to participate in Dr. Floyd. He had a special Dragon Con episode that he wrote up, and I was, of course, the gamer. And yes, I played it very stereotypically. I had one line, and I took the voice of the comic book guy from The Simpsons. I'm not going to try to do it here. The voice isn't quite up to it right now. I did feel a little bad playing the stereotypical gamer, you know, the typical nerd, but it's what the role called for. All the other people, there was a Klingon and a Filk singer, and they were all stereotypical roles too. So, anybody, if you were there and you heard me and you weren't offended, I'm sorry, but That's what it was. Unfortunately, Grant had some trouble recording through this setup there, so it was a one-time performance. Those hardy souls who were there got a rare treat. The rest of you lose out. Oh, and there is usually a big celebrity guest on Dr. Floyd, and this one was the great Luke Ski, and his wife participated too as one of the folk singers. Then after that, I made it to the Parsec Losers Party, and I was there watching Murr write her famous essay, if you know anything about that. If you don't, I recommend going to www.michaelandevo.com and catch Winging It, where you can hear Murr's famous, I won't say the word, essay. I actually got to respond a little bit part of that. People wanted to know what I thought of certain parts of her essay, and I let them know. Got a few laugh lines out of that. You can hear me there as well. And after that, I mean, who can top that? But we went back to Michael Eneva's room and drank more beer. And there I drank the evil beer, which is Midas Touch, which is made by the Dogfish, I think that's the name, brewery. It's located in Delaware. And I really regretted that the next day. Later discovered, I mean, I did know that the beer was beer, plus some mead, plus some wine. And it was also 9% alcohol. So the next morning, I wasn't doing too well. In any case, I did manage to get up to see the Mythbusters do their thing, which was really cool. It's one of my favorite shows. And then I went to see Murr's game business talk. She was essentially doing the same talk that I was doing the day before, but doing that from the paper RPG business perspective. And then we went out to dinner with John Smarr and Laura Burns. So, hi to you both. And after that, I had a fairly mellow night watching the masquerade. And after that, it was to home. The only real game I participated in was that killer breakfast, which I don't think really counts. We did pick up a couple games at Z-Man Games booth. We picked up another movie genre game, and I got No Thanks, or German version is Geschenkt. We haven't had a chance to try them out yet. Maybe we'll give them a try next week. I mean, I didn't really get to the dealer room at all. I went around to the main dealer room, which is in the very basement of the Marriott, but I didn't get to what's called the exhibitor room. And the very last half hours there, I kind of did a quick tour around the exhibitor room and found the used game booth, and unfortunately didn't really have enough time to peruse it or find a game there. I did find an old copy of Cosmic Encounter, which I pointed John to. But beyond that, I just had to go. So that was the only unfortunate part of Dragon Con there. So that's about it for Dragon Con. It was a pretty whirlwind tour, other than all of the sleeping parts at the beginning and sort of at the middle end there. I did have a lot of fun, and I met a lot of cool people there. The other thing was, it was the first year I really participated in a lot of things, and that was a lot of fun too, so I'm going to have to do as much, if not more, next year. Once again, I want to thank Murr, Mike, and Tracy for setting up the track, as well as Derek and Swoopy for running it. And if I met you at DragonCon, please drop me an email and say hello. I know I met a lot of listeners there, but I'm wretched with names, so do let me know. So that's it for Dragon Con. I will be back with a quick overview review of Moonshot right after this.
Hi, this is Richard Denning here with news of UK Games Expo 2007. The UK has a long tradition of gaming in all forms, but we look with envy at mainland Europe and the USA, and their large international games conventions attracting to tens of thousands of players of all forms of games. In the UK, we are very much in their shadow. The UK Games Expo team believes that the UK deserves a showcase convention of the very best in the world of gaming, whether it be miniature gaming, board games, card games, role-playing games, or computer games. 2007 sees the launch of UK Games Expo in Birmingham, in the Clarendon Suites, just off the Hagley Road, on the 2nd and 3rd of June 2007. We will have a large trade hall offering all forms of gaming. There will be demonstrations and participation games of all sorts. There will be some fun pick-up games such as radio-controlled events. You will be able to sit down and try out massively multiplayer online events and have a go at some LAN gaming. If you are a serious competition type player, you can enter tournaments in board games and war games. If you want to know more about the event, check out www.ukgamesexpo.co.uk and keep your ear open, because I'll be back with some more news in a few months' time.
So, welcome back. After Dragon Con, we of course had our usual gaming night, and Pat Barry brought over one of his favorite games, which is called Moonshot. And he's a big space program nut, and this is a themed game based on the American space program. It was self-published by a guy named Van Oberbay through his company called Galactic Attic in 1997. It looks like it was just a limited run of 5,000 copies. As I mentioned, the theme is the American space race, and it goes from the Mercury to the Apollo missions. It does not include Apollo Soyuz or Skylab, or anything beyond that even. It does include the failed missions like Apollo 1 and Apollo 13, and you can actually carry those missions out, assuming that the other players don't screw you up. But I'll get to that in a sec. Now, oddly, you would think a space race game would be Russians versus the US, but in this one, each player plays the US. You start off with your single piece on one of four Earth spaces. There is one at each corner, one for each player, assuming you play up to four. From there, you move into an inner ring, which represents all of the missions. And there's a symbol on each space that represents the mission. It's the actual mission patch. And I'll talk a little bit more later on how this actually works as part of the game. And then finally, there are some connections to the final inner space, which is the moon. Now, there's a deck of cards, and cards consist of various things, one of which is missions. You pull out all the missions to start out with, and then deal out six missions to each player. And each player has to complete six missions, and then move a marker to the moon to win the game. There's no actual mission to get to the moon, you just kind of go there. After each player has received six missions, the remaining mission cards are shuffled into the rest of the deck, and eight cards dealt to each player. Now, you complete a mission by playing cards. Under each mission is sort of a launch pad space, virtually speaking. And on that, you'll need to play a booster rocket and the necessary payloads to complete the mission. So, for example, you might need a Saturn V booster and a command module and a lunar module to complete Apollo 11. As I said, you play these as cards from your hand. And the number of cards you can actually play on your turn is limited by fuel. You have a set of fuel cards, which are used up during your turn and then recycled at the beginning of your next turn. And each card that you want to play from your hand has a fuel cost. So, for example, you might play a card, it costs one fuel, so you'll use up one fuel and then put the card down and then work your way up to, I think you start off with nine fuel. Pat's probably going to write me and correct me at some point, but I'm doing this from memory here. And then you actually launch a mission by expending fuel as well. So there is a cost to place the booster card, and then on the booster itself it also has a cost for launching the booster. Then, after that, you can move a piece around the board. This also uses up more fuel, and you can keep doing this until you land at the mission space. It might take you a few turns to do that. Now, the number of spaces you move will depend on, A, how much fuel you have left, plus each booster rocket has a maximum number of spaces that it can move. For example, the Apollo missions allow you to move more spaces than the Mercury missions, which kind of makes sense. It's a bigger rocket. Now, once you get to the space, you get a marker that indicates that you have mission completion, plus you also get more fuel. So as you progress through the game, you can do more and more things, put down more missions, and progress faster and faster that way. So one thing you could do is start off with a Mercury mission, which is relatively cheap in terms of payload cost, booster cost, and the amount of fuel necessary to move and to launch. Get some fuel from that, and then start to work up to the Gemini and to the Apollo. Although it is possible to start off with the Apollo, it takes a little bit more time, but you do get more fuel out of completing an Apollo mission. so it can give you a big boost up. Basically, you catch up quickly, even though you started with a slower mission. If that was all there was to the game, that would be a little too easy. And people who are well-versed in the Apollo program know that Apollo 1, there was a fire at launch, which killed the astronauts on board, and Apollo 13, there was, I believe, an oxygen tank exploded, which had them fail the mission. So, there are similar failures that can be played on you by your opponents. So it's a bit of a take that game in that respect. So maybe your booster blows up, or maybe your launch is just scrubbed, or just delayed for a couple turns. Fortunately, there aren't all that many disasters, so you don't have to always feel like you're under attack. And once somebody plays it, you can see that it gets discarded and it's there, and you don't have to worry about it anymore. So there's only a certain number of cards that, say, affect the Gemini missions. So if you have a Gemini missions, you know all those cards have been played, you can feel pretty free about proceeding with your Gemini mission and knowing that it'll complete safely. Also, there are cards that let you counteract them. So if someone plays something that, say, would normally scrub your mission, you can play another card that counteracts it. Even if all else fails, usually you have another mission going on, and you're trying to get all your cards down out of your hand so you can draw new ones. So even if you have some primary mission you're working on, you usually have a secondary one you're just trying to fill up by getting cards out of your hand. So if you lose the primary, you can continue with the secondary. A few other rules that help out with the take-that-ness of it, if that's a word, are the fact that at the end of your turn, before you draw back up to 8, you have to discard a card, which the next player may take. So, if you screw them, they might be able to use that discard against you. Now, of course, people discard carefully with that in mind. In addition to that, you can decide to scrub any incomplete mission and replace it with a mission card from your hand. This means that you have to dump anything you had on the launch pad for that mission, but it might mean that you can make better progress. For example, I had a Mercury mission that was going nowhere because I just couldn't get the cards. So I scrubbed it and replaced it with a Gemini mission for which I had all the necessary equipment already in my hand. I think I like this game better than a lot of other take-that games for that reason. It always feels like you're making progress even when you do have a setback. So for an example, in our game, we all ended up pretty close to winning even though a couple of people shot off to a big start. I was in last place for quite a while and nearly squeaked out a win. I did get all 6 missions launched and was heading towards the moon, but Christiana Ellis of Nina Kimberly podcast fame, if you're familiar with that, did get to the moon first. It's a good educational game, too. Teaches a lot about the space missions, gives you the dates and all the various equipment involved, and those disasters as well. For example, I didn't realize that the Gemini missions involved docking with a probe in orbit, at least some of the Gemini missions. By the way, you can lose the probe, too. And as Pat likes to put it, as Pat Barry, the guy who brought the game over, it's surprising that this game isn't in every NASA-related gift shop. It's very educational. It's certainly a step up over most tie-in games, and it's got some really nice photo art as well. Again, thanks to NASA. It's kind of boggling there. But the game is actually out of print now. There used to be a company website, galacticaddict.com, and that's gone as well. I believe, based on some comments that I found online, there were some card expansions for the game, but I don't think those are available since that site is actually gone. If you do want to find a copy of it, I mean, it's pretty cheap on eBay. You can get it for about $10. There was another seller that was selling it for $50, but I don't think it's quite worth that much money. I don't think this game is necessarily for everyone. I mean, it does have that take-that component, which turns a lot of people off. I do think that the Space Nuts will enjoy it, and there is that collectible component to it as well. I mean, there's only 5,000 copies out there, folks. As a side note, if you are looking for it, there is another Moonshot game out there, but it was printed in the 70s, I think 1973. The subtitle is the Lunar Power Game. I don't really have any more information on the game than that. I just saw it when I was doing an eBay search for this Moonshot game. The Moonshot game that I'm reviewing here has a picture of the footprint on the moon. I think it might be a Neil Armstrong's footprint. At this point, rather than going to break and doing feedback like I normally do, I think I'm actually just going to wrap it up. My voice is, I mean, if you can tell, it's kind of going, and I'm kind of run down as well. Despite that, I do say I do appreciate the feedback that I have gotten in the past 2 weeks. And I know I haven't answered my emails. I've been bad. I'm sorry. But I do promise I will answer them soon. I am still trying to recover from Dragon Con, and I think there's some residual sickness that's even pre-Dragon Con as well. But once I get enough sleep and get some rest, I will get back into the swing of things. If you do want to send me feedback, you can do that via email at vintagejim@gmail.com or Skype via username jvsquare. You can just pop in and chat with me. I love to chat with people. Or, of course, you can leave comments on the website, which is www.vintagegamer.net. And as I always say, feedback is always appreciated. So, thus concludes yet another historic episode of The Vintage Gamer. Our theme is performed by the trio Music of the Spheres, and available on the album of the same name at magnatune.com. Your humble host is Jim Van Verth. The next episode of The Vintage Gamer will cover the awful green things from outer space. So please, stop asking me about it. Until then, keep trying those new games, but don't forget to play the old ones. Thanks for listening.